I'm not going to go through your predictions for the election, but I am going to go through your views on what's happening with crime in South Africa. Is there any light on the horizon?
Yeah, it's a sad...
Is it switched on?
It is on.
It's a sad state of affairs, Alec. We have a situation now where the police are unable to investigate the number of dockets that are being opened. So they have to take a decision as to which ones they are going to investigate. And there's no intelligence being applied in making that decision. So a docket which would be easy to prosecute is left lying on the side. And a docket which is going to be hard to prosecute and hard to investigate is worked on. And that is a problem because the criminals are getting away with crime. The clear-up rate on murder now is less than 7%, which means if I kill 12 people, I better stop because on the 13th person, I might get caught. And that is a problem. It means people are able to commit murder at a rate of knots without being caught. And the same applies to other contact crimes like robbery and rape and crimes like that. But the biggest crimes now taking place in South Africa in terms of rand value is fraud, white-collar crime. We're now covering crime. You're going to be shocked. We have done cases in the last 18 months involving white-collar crime where the profile of the criminal is white Afrikaans, male or female. Now, that's unbelievable. I've got two ladies, two sisters, who swiped 137 million from their employer over a period of 9 years because the employer had two sisters. You know, we talk about segregation of duties. Well, if you have segregation of duties to prevent fraud, you should also segregate family members. Because when you have two sisters on either side of the segregated duties, it's cheers. They clean them out. 137 million. I had another case involving a guy, white Afrikaans male, who stole 35 million over a period of 10 years. And him and his family lived like kings, and nobody picked it up. And the reason they didn't pick it up, because of the lack of segregation, that same guy was the IT general manager and he was an accounts manager for a large part of their portfolio. So he was able to clean his track as he went along. So I'm afraid crime in South Africa at the moment, it's not looking good.
We had an interesting issue not long ago that there was a very famous rugby player, Hannes Strydom, that called you in. I mean, this is really a well worth repeated story. Hannes Strydom was a member of the 95 Rugby World Cup team. Tell us the story.
He played in that final. He was in the 95 team. And he came to us because somebody had been stealing from him. And we were able to identify the staff members in question that had been stealing from him. And they'd stolen, I think, somewhere in the region about 30 million. And they were actually also white. And then they were committing their theft through buying and selling of product under the counter. So they were buying, I forget the name of the drug in it, like a cough syrup. That apparently certain drug addicts buy this cough syrup and they drink a whole bottle to get a high.
Codeine.
That's it, codeine. And these guys were buying truckloads of cough syrup. And when it was being delivered, it was immediately going out again to the black market. And Hannes Strydom, it would appear, he didn't disclose it to us. By the time we figured it out, he'd actually passed away. He'd driven into the back of a taxi on the N4 freeway coming back from Witbank or somewhere. But quite clearly, that type of crime is kept. I live in Sandton, and you won't believe it. There's a house down the road from me near Barlow Park, and they put a white sign like that size, illuminated sign on the wall, and it's white with a green leaf on the white circle. And the leaf is a dacha leaf, you know, a cannabis leaf on the sign. Now, this is a residential area. So I did some investigation. I sent some undercover people in there, and they're selling drugs. And they put a bloody sign up outside the house to let you know that you can get your drugs there. And I mean, this is now what's going on with crime in South Africa. And if you think that's bad, just stop a minute, because the UK is having some serious issues. The police now don't even want to take a report unless it was a serious matter or it's required for insurance purposes. I live out near Uxbridge. I have a house there. I have other properties in the UK as well, but when I'm in London, my home is out near Uxbridge. And I take this new Elizabeth line. It's quite good. You can go from Bond Street. The wife loves it. You can get from there to Bond Street in 22 minutes. Now, that's pretty marvelous stuff. But when you get off the train, I either get off at West Drayton or Iver. Now, the problem with going on to Iver is that your Oyster card doesn't go past West Drayton. So I park my car at West Drayton, and then I get off the train at West Drayton. I came into town on Sunday. I had meetings in town. And I went out plus minus 4 p.m., and when I went down, I saw these three, and I'm pretty good at identifying people because I spent a few years in the border police. And I looked at them and I thought, they're Afghanis. They're from Afghanistan. They were sitting opposite me on the train. And I got on the carriage where I knew it's right when it stops, it's right next to the steps. You can just walk down. They obviously did the same. And the three of them went down the steps, and I've got my Oyster card. The three of them go down the steps, and they just jump over the barrier. And not being one to see people committing crime and getting away with it, I decided to follow them. So I took photographs of them. I made a note of the time exactly, because they have CCTV on all these barriers, and I followed them. And they weren't walking fast, so it was easy to keep up with them. Of course, I had to come back and get my car. But I walked half an hour to their hotel, which is the Holiday Inn, the big, tall, it's a 10-story building near Heathrow, the Holiday Inn at Heathrow. And I saw the three of them walk straight in, and there were two security guards on the door. I'd taken a number of photographs of them along the way. And as they walked in, I tried to walk in behind them because I wanted to see how they were checking in or whatever. And the security guard say, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going into the hotel. No, this I'm not the hotel anymore. I said, well, what? Holiday Inn. He said, no, this not anymore hotel. No. I said, well, what is it then? It's not the hotel. I said, is it for refugees? He said, yeah, it's for refugees. A 10-story Holiday Inn hotel at Heathrow is now for refugees. So I came to the conclusion that because these guys, they knew exactly what they were doing. This wasn't their first trip over the barrier. So you've got all these refugees pouring into the country. And by the way, they're now heading to Northern Ireland, because the Northern Ireland Supreme Court has ruled that they can't be extradited to Rwanda. And then when they get to Northern Ireland, they hear that they're actually conditions are quite good in Dublin. So now you have a situation in Dublin where what used to be called pop concerts can't be put on anymore. You can never hold a pop concert in Dublin now. Why? Because 50% of the hotels in Dublin are now filled up with asylum seekers or refugees or whatever you want to call it. So all the other hotels are booked solid and the rates are through the roof. So nobody can put in a pop concert in Dublin anymore. So things aren't as great as they might look at first hand in the UK, I want to tell you. And you'll see them sleeping on the streets everywhere.
Yeah, the world has got some serious challenges. A couple of questions for you, Paul. From Wendy, she wants to know, how are you alerted to crimes, from and particularly white-collar crime? Does it come from whistleblowers?
Well, so it depends. On the charity side, which is Forensics for Justice, we have a hotline. It's 0800 118 118. And people often phone in and they give us a tip-off. Of course, you can't act on every single tip-off. You have to validate it first. And then we also have an email address. Not a proper email address, but you can go on the website and you can actually type in. And you don't have to leave a telephone number and you don't have to leave your email address. The problem is sometimes people, we have a box for you to fill in if you want to fill it in, but sometimes people leave leads, which when you look at it, you can't do anything with it. It's absolutely useless. It'll say something like, I know of a guy that works at the city council in Johannesburg who's stealing money every week, or something like that, you know? And I mean, no number, no email address. There's not enough detail to follow up. So a lot of the leads we get, you can't follow up. But we get some cracking leads. I mean, that Transnet thing, we got on a lead. So it was a worker that worked for CMC de Ravenna that actually gave us that lead. And we met with him and he gave us all the information. And that was like four point something billion rand corruptly awarded tender. So we were able to stop that one. So we've had some really good leads, yeah.
On the subject of foreign conspired fraud, what did you discover investigating John Stratton? That was on the cable fraud. John South Stratton. Africa must improve to prevent the relative ease of the likes of Gupta's, Tannenbaum, etc.
So John Stratton, God bless his cotton socks, was they used to call him the turtle because he was a very skinny, scrawny individual. And his shirt sizes were about, his collar sizes were about three sizes too big. So he had this little neck sticking out of a collar. So they used to call him the turtle. John Stratton was the puppet master for Brett Kebble. And what John Stratton did was he stole, I think, about $360 million from JCI. He collapsed. He collapsed JCI. Well, it's up and running again now. I think it's uncollapsible because of the base assets they have. Investec came off. They lost a lot of money. A lot of companies lost. Alan Gray Investments lost a lot of money. So it was mostly shareholder collapse that took place. The share value was gone. But John Stratton arranged for the murder of Brett Kebble. And there's no such thing as assisted suicide. You've got to look at the legislation. Shooting a guy through the head because he said he wants to die. Every psychiatrist should keep a gun in the drawer. You feel what? You know, that's you taken care of. Next customer, please. You know, at the end of the day, he was murdered. And he was murdered because Stratton wanted him murdered. And the reason Stratton wanted him murdered was because he swiped $360 million. And that money went to Australia. I had him prosecuted in Australia because he couldn't be extradited. You know, under Australian law, there was a Supreme Court of Appeal judgment, must be 20 years ago now, that found that living or sleeping or eating in a South African jail was contrary to your human rights. And therefore, people that have to go to prison won't be extradited from Australia. We still extradite people to Australia. The mind boggles because when you get there, you get a room with a TV, a color TV. You play table tennis. You get nice meals. There's a menu. You know, jail in Australia is pretty. It's the real deal. So John Stratton, we went there, and I had the camera crew in his face. There was ABC program called Four Corners, and they did a one-hour show on John Stratton. And the West Australian, which is the Perth newspaper, they did a whole big coverage on John Stratton. So after that, him and his wife would go shopping separately because she didn't want to be seen with him. But John Stratton pretty much got away with it. Because he was 80-something years old, when he was convicted of the fraud, by the way, he was convicted of bringing the proceeds of crime into Australia, not fraud. And when he was convicted of that, he was fined. So you can commit crime in Australia and get a slap on the wrist.
Well, those of you who didn't follow the story, Brett Keble controlled a company called Randgold Resources through
JCI.
Randgold. So he had JCI Randgold. Randgold Resources was spectacularly successful. It's run by the guy who's now the chief executive of the biggest gold mining company, Barrick, Mark Bristow. Mm. And what they did was they took the shares in Randgold Resources and kept selling them as the share price was going up. So they got to a point there were no shares left in the company, but according to the annual report, there were lots of shares there. So that's what happened. So you can now see that the $360 million of South African shareholder money in Randgold and JCI disappeared. My dear friend, late friend Barry Sargent, wrote a lot about that. Question, Paul, could you paint a picture of what you see happening over the next 5 years with crime and policing in South Africa? That's from Tim.
Okay, so I do believe that if we keep the pressure on, and I do keep the pressure on, the criminal justice system will improve. Now, I have regular meetings with Andrea Johnson, who runs the, they call it the ID, the investigative directorate, and some of the investigators working under her. But they are a little bit like what the Scorpions used to be like, but they're a limited group. You could put the whole of the ID into this room and still have a lot of empty seats. So they can only manage certain types of crime. But I'm finding pockets of excellence in the criminal justice system. So what we do is we try to promote those pockets of excellence. We offer free training to people in the white collar area because most of them haven't had formal training. So they just don't understand what's going on. In the courts, we're very lucky now because we have specialized commercial crime courts, and those judges have all been trained as to what constitutes a crime in the commercial and how the crimes are committed. And I know because I was involved in that training. So a lot of those judges got really good training. And then we have prosecutors in that SCCU who are specialized prosecutors. So on the white collar side, we are starting to make some sort of a headway there. But I did a little analysis a few weeks ago, and I thought if all the white collar criminals stop committing crime today, it'll take 17 years to investigate and prosecute the backlog. And I did the same analysis on Sondo, and I came to something like 25 years. With the team that they have in their ID, it would take them 25 years to clean up the Sondo. So what they have to do is cherry pick. I hate it now when I see a charge sheet of 1,800 charges. We must go for the low-hanging fruit, 5 or 6 charges, whack them away. Even if they only get 5 years instead of 10 years, justice was served because they're out of the system.
Didn't they do that in another way with Marcus Huster? With the
well, Marcus Huster did his own justice. So Marcus Huster did his own justice, but had he have gone to trial, it would have been a low-hanging fruit job.
But my point was the Financial Conduct Authority, where the day after they published their results, which showed that he was just a common hood, actually, that he had changed lots of figures.
Yeah.
That's when he committed suicide. Then he knew the game was up.
Yeah.
And they had cherry-picked again an area rather than trying to solve the whole mystery.
Well, if you read the Constitution is very clear that if you're going to be put on a trial, if you charge a guy with 1,800 charges. How do I know this? In 1994, we arrested a guy called Andre Boer. I was in the police then. We arrested Andre Boer for stealing money from senior citizens. He was running a retirement village scam. And in 1994, he stole something like 24 million rand, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in 1994, that was a lot of money. And we locked him up. The trial lasted 3 years. And at the end of the trial, I was sitting with the prosecutor and the regional court magistrate, because we didn't have specialized commercial crime courts then. We were having lunch at the Rand Club on me. And as I was getting stuck into my treacle toffee pudding with custard, the magistrate says, because this guy got actually 300 and something years, an effective 15 years. The magistrate said, of course, if you'd have only charged him with 10 or 20 charges, he would have still got 15 years, but the trial would have been over in 3 weeks instead of 3 years. I learned from that. So now when we put dockets together, we go for the low-hanging fruit. And when we get a prosecutor that tells us, no, we must charge him with that, we must charge him with that, and charge him with that, we say, ah, this is what we're charging with. We're not interested in the rest of the stuff.
Three questions just to close off with, Paul. What needs to be done from Dean to sort out the police and or justice system? And can it be done?
Yeah, it can be done. If it couldn't be done, I wouldn't be living in Joburg now. I would have packed my bags and gone already. In fact, I was sitting in council's chambers on Friday last week having a discussion because, you know, I'm suing the state for, I don't know, 160 million or something like that because of the things they did to me. And in our analysis, we decided to amend our plea because the criminal justice system is in such a bad state now. If it carries on like this, you're going to end up with gated communities with armed guards at the gate. And when you drive out, you're going to be driving out into it's almost going to be like one of these futuristic movies where you're going to be ducking and diving the bullets. And that's, if it carries on like it is, that's the way South Africa will end up. But I see a brighter future. I start to see now, I put the list up there of the cops. When you've got leaders, if you've got a general in the police that uses a police helicopter to do his, to go to a meeting 200 kilometers away in a police helicopter when he can drive there. And when you've got a chief of police who goes to a function overseas paid for by a police supplier and comes back with a Louis Vuitton bag for his wife, the future doesn't look good. But I do believe there are good people out there. I meet them on a regular basis, and I'm now working behind the scenes to get them into positions of authority. And the proof of that is Shadrach Sabir. I got him back into the police, and he's now Deputy National Commissioner of Police.
Well, that's good news. How much of a threat, asks Chris, is Russian interference in the upcoming elections?
I don't think there's any threat at all from Russia, but, you know, I'm slightly biased. I own property in Russia. So I don't believe there's a threat into the elections from Russian interference. I mean, what are they going to do? Have guys telling you who to vote for when you're standing in the queue? I don't see any threat. What we do know, as you know, my daughter, who's an analyst, she's a professor at Harvard. She did an analysis of the Russian. It was a company called Cambridge Analysts based here, and they actually ran a campaign in the U.S. election to help Trump to stay in power because they didn't want Joe Biden in. Now, Trump also ran a campaign to help himself to stay in power. It didn't work. My understanding is that they're already busy with the next elections in the U.S. The elections in South Africa, I'm sorry to say, are not of so much significance to the Russians as they would be, for example, in the U.K. or the U.S.
And the last question is your daughter. I don't know if it's the same daughter because you've got quite a few kids, but the one who's writing the book on Taylor Swift. It's actually an extraordinary story. Paul has very strong genes because the people the kids that he's produced are super smart. And this daughter was given a, can you say the royalty?
Yeah, she was given $500,000 upfront payment. My second eldest daughter is a space scientist. She's the only professor at Harvard that lectures on interplanetary economics. So she's also an economist, and she's in the process of writing a book now on the economy of Taylor Swift. Because the economy of Taylor Swift, believe it or not, according to her, so I'm not saying this is the case, and I've got to remember what she told me correctly, but she says Taylor Swift is to the United States as, what was the name of that for, Mamma Mia, what's the name of that, ABBA. She says Taylor Swift is to the US economy as ABBA was to the Swedish economy. And that Taylor Swift was the first self-made billionaire in pop. Now, I probably wouldn't believe any of that crap, except some of my other daughters are Swifties. And do you know what a Swiftie is? So my youngest daughter, who's 16 years old, and I have five daughters and two sons, my youngest daughter has created a whole business out of making bracelets, Taylor Swift bracelets. And she's selling these things online, and she had to replace all of the equipment that she makes them with because it was taking her too long to make them. And she's now bought some automated machinery, a 16-year-old girl. And she's pushing this stuff out in volumes, Taylor Swift bracelets. So, I mean, you know, to have a daughter that's writing a book on Taylor Swift and to get a big deposit like that. So I said, well, they must be expecting to sell quite a few books. They're estimating this book will be the bestseller because everybody, apparently, I'm not a Swiftie, but apparently a lot of people on the planet are Swifties.
But I did read the email she sent you, and it's much more than that. It's a whole change in the economy, and we're seeing it. This lady's been published in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, here at the FT.
The New Yorker.
New Yorker. That was the
she just
thing
did
I was
an
reading.
Article now in the New Yorker.
That was the piece. And it's about the way the economy is changing. So anyway, there's a little punt for, is it Siobhan?
Sinead.
Sinead O'Sullivan, who will be the next best-selling author, Harvard professor, but with a South African connection. Paul,
you
thank
can Google
you
it. Just Google Sinead O'Sullivan, Harvard Interplanetary Economics. You'll see it. Cheers.